It's time for Valley Edition, a weekly panel discussion on current issues in the Mat-Su Valley, moderated by Mike Malevsky.
Well, folks, once again, it's my great pleasure to welcome into the studio Mark Kelsey. Welcome, Mark.
Good morning, Mike.
And Zaz Hollander. Welcome, Zaz.
Hey, Mike and Mark.
And this is for another edition of Valley Edition. And it's been a, I guess crazy week is one way to look at it, in the sense that we are hitting the end of the year. And we've looked back, and there are a number of things that are happening that began a year ago. And I'm going to start with the one that has been, I think, receiving a significant amount of attention, and that will be the school board meeting of Wednesday. And I know that you were there, Zaz. I was there for a while, listened to the rest of it. What was your impression of the reasons why 300 people would come to a meeting like that and leave standing room only?
It's the reason that usually teachers pack school board meetings, and it was a contract issue. And just good, good PR by the teachers union, the Mat-Su Education Association. But there were probably 300 people in that room. I'm not sure how many of them I had to leave about halfway through, but a number of them spoke during the first half hour of audience participation. But yes, and there was a representative of the Public Education Health Trust, which is a nonprofit affiliated with NEA Alaska that provides insurance for Mat-Su teachers. And Rhonda Kittle was there. She's the CFO for the trust. And the school board kind of grilled her. The school board is pressing the trust to provide claim information about the Mat-Su teachers. And that seemed to me to be kind of the biggest bone of contention. The teachers are concerned that their private medical information and their family's medical information will be turned over to the district. And they're accusing the district of doing that because the district wants to switch to a self-insurance model and kind of wants to see what they've got. The district is saying, well, we're just putting all of our options out there. They haven't made any decisions yet, and they're kind of in the information gathering stage. So there was a lot of back and forth about, we would just like some more information to help us decide if you, the trust, are the best source for us to use for health insurance and the most cost-effective source. And the trust is pushing back and saying, in all of our 21 years, we've never released that information, and we're not going to do that now. So that's a little bit of an impasse, which matches the contract impasse that I don't know if disingenuous is the right word, but I was surprised. The tone I heard from some of the comments from the teachers was, go back to the table. And then I realized and learned that there is no table right now, that both sides agreed to an impasse in November. And so the next step is for a third-party mediator to come up, I think, from Seattle later this month or early January and start the mediation process.
Mark, you had a question?
Yeah, so how does the self-insurance model work? And, you know, I'm sort
like,
of
like it does
antsy to ask your full disclosure.
Business.
My spouse is a teacher, but I'm curious about your take on that.
I think it's a fairly basic model, Mark. I haven't done much reporting on that yet. It sounds as if other districts do it. Kenai, Fairbanks, Kodiak, I think, were the examples tossed around. At the paper, I think we may look into how that's working in places, in districts where it's in place now.
And presumably it would save money?
Right. That would be. That's what the district is looking for. They spend $40 million a year on health insurance now. That's their second highest cost. The highest is teacher salaries, then insurance, then classified employees. So.
Well, and you've been through this a couple times before. Are you seeing anything different this time? Is the tone different? Are the stakes different? Are they asking for different things?
You know, it does seem like it's a little bit different, and I think the tone is similar to that in Anchorage, where they actually had a contract on the table. And, I talked with some teachers in Mat-Su who said that it seemed like maybe generous is too kind, but not a bad contract. It didn't have a 3% pay increase, but it did have a pretty good step, and it had some good, it seemed like it had some good compromises for teachers, and teachers there rejected it. And so I don't know how much of this is kind of universal in Alaska because of the budget situation, just putting so much pressure on everybody, plus rising health care costs, just that, you know, not to use that old cliche, but it's a perfect storm. But it does seem a little more desperate. It's hard. I mean, to be honest, I find it really difficult to cover teachers' contracts just because, you know, there is a union involved, there is a district involved, and it's often, for me anyway, hard to get to exactly what is going on, you know, what in reality are the facts of the situation.
So following Mark's lead, full disclosure, 21 years ago, I was an employee of the school district and, in fact, chaired the health insurance committee that moved toward a health insurance trust. I subsequently also, in full disclosure, served 2 years on the health trust board of directors. And lastly, I have negotiated both for teachers and for the district over the years. And the reason why I say all of that is because I learned a long, long time ago when first being instructed by a retired superintendent of schools about what you do within negotiations, that the key thing is that when people walk away, it's not a win-lose situation, but that you have actually had true negotiations and that you walk away having had that discussion, you've come up with an agreed-upon solution. And unfortunately, I think I'd agree with you, Zaz, that at this point, very often in the heated piece especially moving toward, you're all away from the table, you're not actually talking anymore, you're going into some form of mediation, it leaves a lot of people hanging. But the other piece is that the health trust in 21 years has a record that can be looked at. Now, I haven't followed it in the last few years to say it's better than. I think, however, the concept is the important thing. The health trust concept was that if two things happen, one, you enlarge the number of people who participate, and it's important to remember it's not just Mat-Su that's in the health trust, but Anchorage. You have a larger pool of people, and many people.
6,000 members, I think it is.
Right. And so when you have that number, you tend to smooth out the cost fluctuations that occur. So whenever you're going to go down to a smaller group, their tip, I think it's safe to say, in inevitable larger swings in terms of costing. The second point that's made is the question of negotiation capability. And what I learned a long time ago is that many of the real cost factors are the result of a negotiation between the trust and providers, on the one hand, and secondly, with what is referred to as a third-party administrator. In other words, you hire somebody to handle the very complex process of paying bills. And so those two things come with experience, and I think what I heard the CFO from the trust saying was that we have the experience, this is what we do for negotiation. And my sense was that by saying we have this claim experience, but we're inviting you to go out and get a bid from Primera or your own self, make that work. They will give it to you. And I think that what as the session went on and on happened is that there was a loss of the recognition that, okay, go get the bids without this claim information. If that doesn't prove to be possible or acceptable, then let's go back and talk. But the reality is get those pieces and then talk about what's being offered by a self-insured program, a Primera, and the health trust. And I think that it seemed to me to be something that needed to be done and will probably be done. I would hate to think that the district is saying, no, we're not going to go look unless we have this claims information.
And has the district asked for any concessions from the union on insurance?
Zaz, I think you covered that. Yep.
A little. I mean, a little bit. And again, it's unclear to me right now because there's two different sides saying two different things. But the union and some teachers were saying that the last offer that the district brought to the table included three fewer days pay and I think it was an increase in annual health insurance premiums of over $2,000. I saw $2,100 and $2,300 in two separate places. When I asked the district about that, they said those premiums haven't been set yet. The trust establishes that in the spring. And I think one of the board members was asking Rhonda Kittle about why can't we have that number earlier for budgeting purposes.
And I think the answer to that is that you have to have a complete set of information in order to make those projections. And if you go too soon, they're not going to be as accurate as you would like. But
right.
Yeah.
Well, and so what happens from here? Is there a deadline date or anything that will show an end to this?
Well, presumably
by the time the budget is finalized, they need to know what the health insurance costs are going to be. And but mediation, maybe early January starting. I don't know that. I'm sure there's a firmer timeline than that.
You're going to have some parallel activities occurring, and obviously the district's budget process, the borough assembly, we, of course, running into the legislature. So we have all kinds of moving parts here in terms of, and I would say I would not want to be in the mediator, because what we're trying to do here is make a decision where you don't have the firm figures about some significant pieces such as health insurance and or budget considerations of funding from the state. Well, let's leave that topic because I think we've covered the state of the topic. And move to something else that began a year ago with a death of a young man and now a trial which is coming closer to actually happening. I'm speaking about the Grunewald case. Zaz, you already had some information about that as well.
Yeah, it's been about a year since David Grunewald's body was found. He was murdered in mid-November last year. Allegedly by a group of guys of whom he knew at least a few sort of well, and at a house just outside Palmer, technically, right near the Tsunami Warning Center. And so what's happening now is kind of the lead character in the four defendants charged with murder directly, and then a fifth who's charged as sort of an accessory. Eric Allmendinger, who was 15 or 16 when the murder occurred, and it happened at his house with his dad and grandmother home. It happened the beginning of it happened in a trailer behind the house, and so now Eric Allmendinger's given the publicity that the murder of this kid with at least a clean cut reputation. There's a fair amount of documentation in the files that David Grunewald was this wasn't the first time for him to be around marijuana. So he was at Eric's. He dropped off a friend and then came back later and was drinking and smoking pot with these guys. But that they then beat him badly enough that he was sort of semi-conscious and put him in his own Bronco and drove him out to the Kinnick River. And Eric Allmendinger was the first person to be charged who actually gave the public a narrative into what happened. He had a long interrogation at the Palmer Post with his both of his divorced parents there and his grandmother there, and basically told at least his version of what happened. And so Eric now has been split off from the other defendants for trial. And now his attorney is asking for a change of venue because there were so many people looking for David Grunewald when he was missing and nobody said where he was. And then there was just outrage when his body was found and the story got out of what may have happened, at least what Eric Allmendinger said happened. And there's a lot of discrepancies in his narrative of, well, so-and-so actually pulled the trigger, but no, it was so-and-so. And the other guys are saying, no, it was Eric who pulled the trigger. So the motion for a change of venue was filed last month. The DA filed his opposition to it last week, and the judge chief will have to decide on that. I think it's pretty unlikely, but who knows? I think that trial will be in Palmer. That Kalachak, the district attorney, Roman Kalachak, is arguing that this trial was, or this case was, people throughout Alaska at least could read about it in the newspaper, two newspapers, and could see it on TV news. And the jury process will weed out, you know, if there are people who knew David Grunewald or his family or were involved in the search, the jury selection process will weed them out.
So is there just one person being tried for murder?
No, there's four of them.
But separate trials?
Yeah, there's four charged with murder total, including Eric Allmendinger.
All first degree?
Yeah, but his attorney got him separated for trial, so that the three are still together. The attorneys, they're all public defenders. They're all court-appointed attorneys, and they're waiting to see what happens. They're using Eric's case to see what happens with various. There are a lot of motions out there now. It's a really thick file and a lot of evidence, but they're kind of waiting to see, I assume, what happens with, for example, a change of venue motion before they would file their own.
Okay. So I had the opportunity to interview Stephanie Allen, who is executive director of United Way here in the Valley. And the reason why I bring it up at this point is because she, along with a number of other people from the school district, from the Health Foundation, made a trip to Iceland. Many of you may remember an article that appeared that reviewed what Iceland had done to reduce a significant impact of use of alcohol, drugs, and other things on youth in Iceland. And the article that I remember described a 20-year program that had reduced the heavy use of alcohol from 42% of Iceland's youth to 5%, and all kinds of other significant improvements. And the reason why the group went is because, obviously, we've had various task force and groups looking at opioid and alcohol use here in the Valley, particularly for the youth. And my impression is that when they came back and Stephanie shared that this was a boost toward having a coordinated approach. We know that there have been groups that have been working at task force, for example, and individual organizations that have looked at different aspects of it. But the sense I have is that this is something that is much more comprehensive in saying, okay, what could be learned from that would translate to being used in a different circumstance? We're in the United States, in the Valley, and the populations are different. There may still be a way of doing that to deal with what is sometimes, I think, overlooked as a level of use of drugs or alcohol beneath the surface. It doesn't pop up with arrests and so on. And I think that when we mentioned the Grunewald case, one of the reactions at the time was, whoa, this was a surprise by a number of people. And yet it may be just a look at something that has a larger foundation. In any case, I wanted to mention that because I think we're going to hear much more about it. The Valley Health Foundation, School District, and other groups have been seriously looking at what can be taken from that example. So having said that, I think there's one last piece that's tied to the David Grunewald murder, and that is that David's mother, as I understood, had a file to run for lieutenant governor.
Yeah, that's right.
And has she stated a platform?
Well, certainly criminal justice reform. And she's not a fan of SB 91.
Right. Has she attached herself to a governor candidate?
I think
not as far as I know. We aren't focusing on individual candidates at the expense of being unfair to everybody else.
Right.
So what I would say is that I just put that out there. She's, and we may be hearing more as the time goes on. And we've just begun hearing significant information from the various campaigns. There are two parts here I'd like to just touch upon. One is Governor Walker had a fundraising event in Palmer, And it was well attended, wide range of different people that attended that. And of course, I mention that because there is still the question which has been brought up about whether he would run in a Republican primary or not. Mark, did you have any comment about that?
No. Well, there was also a question about whether there would be a Democratic candidate. And I think as the calendar comes to an end here, that seems to be increasingly unlikely that at least a high profile Democratic candidate, you know, say a Mark Begich, doesn't seem like he's going to get into the race now. The crowd at the fundraiser, though, was that?
It was across the board.
Bipartisan?
Oh, I saw Republicans. I'm talking about prominent Republicans, prominent Democrats, prominent independents. It was a range that you might expect because, in some respect, you know, thinking of the governor running 4 years ago, it was an odd combination, and I won't go into all of it, but essentially a Republican and Democrat running together as a coalition, cooperative.
A unity ticket.
Unity ticket. And now that the time has gone by, we're faced with two aspects of this. One, where does the governor run? Does he run in the Republican primary, the Democratic primary, no primary, just run? And, of course, this has been heated up also by the Republican Party's Representative Tuckerman Babcock, saying that if, for example, you broke from the Republican Party in the Alaska State Legislature and didn't stay with the minority or the Republican group in the House and went over to the coalition, then you shouldn't be allowed to run in the primary. And that's raised all kinds of questions about a definition of...
And these are people who are registered Republicans.
Right. If I register as a Republican and I want to run in the primary, but I don't agree that I will go in lockstep with whatever platform there is, can I be thrown out as not being a real Republican? It gets very messy. Very messy. And I'm not quite sure what...
And not productive for the general good, I would add.
So this is just the beginning of this process. There's been a number of petitions, initiatives, and so on. I just want to say that in some respects, we've signaled the beginning of the political period of candidacies, et cetera, and we go from there. So what I would like to ask, we have a few minutes left here, is to begin this process. We have a couple more Valley editions before we end up the year. But as you're thinking back over the year, of all the things that have happened in 2017, which newsworthy event remains with you as the most significant? Let's start with you, Zaz.
Jeez. well, I mean, the Grunewald case, it just keeps, I mean, that's kind of the big one that I've been tracking, and I think partly because that one taps into the other big story, which may be more, I don't want to say it's a bigger story, but a broader story about crime and criminal justice reform. You know, so SB 91, property crime increases, less funding for troopers, that whole ball of wax. That may be the big one.
Okay. Mark?
Well, I would like to talk about something that may not be a specific event, but it's certainly newsworthy, and it's more about a story from the previous year, 2016, that is still unfolding, so to speak. There was mostly due to the layoffs in the oil industry, big out-migration from the state in 2016, and that has had and continues to have a spillover effect in the housing market, especially for rental properties. The vacancy rate for rental properties in Anchorage went from 3.8, I think, in 16 to over 5 by mid of 2017. It's expected to get closer to the statewide average of 7.3 by the end of the year. Here in the Mat-Su, the vacancy rate for rental properties more than doubled from under 4 to over 7. And the same thing happened in Kenai. So this is something, and these, you know, 4, 5, 6% vacancy rate for rentals is not huge, but when you talk about a doubling of the rate in a year, it definitely shows that we are continuing to see the effects of layoffs and how that spills over into other sectors of the economy. Stay tuned in 2018 for more.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I will offer mine, and mine's a little bit different than both of yours, and it has to do with the Alaska State Legislature's extended sessions that have moved on with it, what appears to be the bare minimum of success in terms of addressing the large, the fundamental problem of the budget. And I think that in great part underlies both of what you're talking about. The financial condition of the state is affected, it is said, by a lack of final settlement on the budget gap. And it also feeds right into things we were talking about earlier when we talk about negotiations, whether it's Anchorage or Mat-Su, and it feeds into the whole issue of crime. One of the reasons why the SB 91 process went on, it was said, was to save money and in addition to be more effective in combating crime. But people have been concerned, I think, that the legislature has been dragging not only its feet, but bodies in coming to some way of saying, okay, let's do this. And I think that's the big thing about 2017 for me. That lack of attention to coming to some conclusion is a big deal, fundamental. So I throw that out in any case. Okay, so with that, I think we've come to the end of another edition of Valley Edition. And I really want to thank Zaz Hollander for calling in today. Thank you, Zaz.
You're welcome. Good to be here with you both.
And I want to thank Mark Kelsey for coming all the way into the studio. Thank you, Mark.
See you all next week.
Okay, and stay dry and drive carefully out there because we have this up and down weather. It just keeps happening.
You've been listening to Valley Edition, a weekly panel discussion on current issues in the Mat-Su Valley, moderated by Mike Malevsky. Valley Edition is a production of Radio Free Palmer, recorded at our studios in Palmer, Alaska. The views and opinions of hosts or guests do not necessarily represent those of Radio Free Palmer, this station, or its underwriters. If you have any comments or questions about this program, email manager@radiofreepalmer.org.